It's like coming home to yourself, your old self. And like I told you, the self is the container. So when you start looking deeper inside, and the most beautiful part about yoga is that it teaches you this quality of non-judgment. See, being an animal.
Hi everyone, I'm Laura and welcome back to Mind Brew Chats. This is part one of a special two-part episode on yoga, spirituality, and mental health. Now for those of you who don't already know, I'm a pharmacist by training and I still work full-time as a pharmacist. I'm very excited today to invite a fellow pharmacist on the show, Jivanti Murugayan, who is not here to talk about medicines, but is here to talk about her personal journey with the healing power of yoga. She's also going to tell us about how yoga strengthens the body, mind, soul connection to build self-awareness and create intimacy with our inner selves. How all of this connects to better mental health, you're going to find out later on in the episode. Jivanti is a full-time pharmacist with the Traditional and Complementary Medicine Division in the Ministry of Health Malaysia. She's also a freelance yoga teacher, health coach, and life coach. A life-changing encounter with the healing power of yoga led her down an almost decade-long journey, exploring otherworld knowledge like yoga, spiritual science, astrology, and Akashic record reading. In 2019, she founded Wild Hearts, Adventures in Mindful Living, in the hopes to bring holistic healing to those who need it. Her voracious appetite for knowledge drives her to continuously expand her consciousness and explore integrative and complementary therapies for better health and well-being. Hi, Jivanti.
Hi, Laura. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a great pleasure to reconnect with you again.
It's been ages since we last spoke, hasn't it? I think at least 6 to 8 years.
I left Sarawak in 2012. So actually, it has been 9 years.
Oh, wow. But yeah. I've been following you on social media and I've seen that you have undergone what can only be described as a metamorphosis. You were transformed from the person that you were to the person that you are now. Could we talk a bit more about what triggered this life change?
Okay, I think to be fair, each one of us as adults are going through this, periods of transformation. I myself have stepped into yoga. I should thank a mental health issues that I was having, by God's grace, I would say that I was actually led into yoga in the middle of an anxiety episode, and it was actually quite severe. Now that I can speak about it without feeling fear, but actually it was a lot of fear that I had. It was actually 9 years ago. So I had an accident while I went diving. So what happened was I actually developed PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. At that time, I was not even aware that it was actually PTSD. I was actually having sort of like a PTSD plus generalized anxiety. And it was quite, I would say it was one of my lowest points in my life. And I was alone because I was living in Sarawak at that time. So, I had, of course, my family was a great support for me at that time, but not having them physically also actually impacted my sort of healing. And I was I am still very thankful for that one very intense pain in my life, because without that PTSD, I would not have found yoga. So that is actually one of my biggest moment of truth. And also, I have a lot of deep gratitude towards that pain, actually. So from that, from how I discovered yoga, then I started to practice more. And then I realized that after about 4 months of daily yoga practice, I completely, I would say I healed. Like, you know, I didn't have everything, all the symptoms that I had completely vanished, you know, for the lack of a better word. And I did not take any medication in that 4 months. Being a pharmacist myself, I don't know, maybe I was just like reading too much into all the long-term side effects of the medication. And maybe that itself sort of like, you know, influenced me not to start psychiatric therapy at that time. But, you know, I just started to feel better as I kept doing yoga. Then I realized that, oh, okay, I've actually passed the pain point, because it was very intense before I started yoga, you know. And then I just decided like, okay, let's just give this a shot. And then after 4 months, I was actually very shocked. Like, wow, something is here. Something deep and something very transformative and healing can happen here, you know, without the use of medicine. Then that's when I decided like I was going to take up my teacher's training. Subsequently, I think about 6 months of continuous practice, and then I enrolled to be a teacher. That was in year 2014. So from 2014 until now, I have studied a few different types of yoga. And then in 2018, I did yoga therapy training, because as a healthcare professional, I thought that I could use a bit of my background to see where yoga can actually help to heal chronic medical issues. And then last year, I enrolled to be to study health and life coach. I'm actually currently finishing up my certification program. It's 2 years with the Institute for Aliveness called TIFA. Basically, my teacher is she's from the US, and I met her in a yoga festival. So what she does is that she created this 2 year certification program of health and life coach. It is based on the fact of using preventive health as a form of well-being. So a lot of what we speak about there is like how you can change your lifestyle to better promote quality of health and longevity. That's where I'm at the moment.
Thank you for sharing that intensely personal story with us. It sounds like you went through a very painful struggle before you hit that moment of truth. And pain is almost always a prerequisite for any sort of transformational change. Now, at this point, I have to insert a disclaimer. Jivanti and I are both pharmacists. We are trained in the Western School of Medicine. And what we're sharing on the show today is not a substitute for expert medical advice. What you hear today is a distillation of our personal experiences, stories, and journey. There's a lot of information out there. And while we do encourage you to do your own research, to find out as much as you can about your own health status, it is very dangerous to self-diagnose or self-treat based on something that you heard on a podcast or read on the internet. So please, if you're experiencing any sort of physical or mental or health condition, do see a doctor, get yourself properly treated and diagnosed.
Exactly, Laura. I do really 100% agree with what you say, because medical intervention is so important to give us that grounding, the initial grounding that we need, because a lot of these mental health issues can be very dysfunctional. So it is also to a degree of how much you know about your physical health and allowing people to support you along the way. And I think that is why we have medical care and psychiatric, you know, medications to help us. Beyond that, then that's really up to the individual preferences to see what are other things that's available to help someone, especially with regards to mental health. Definitely get medical advice and a proper diagnosis.
And that's one reason, or rather the main reason, that we are doing this episode on Mind Brew Chats today. It's to give people a bigger picture worldview of everything that is available, of, you know, possible alternatives that could complement your existing medical treatment.
Right.
Now, that being said, I find this, I've got to ask you this, because we are pharmacists and we are trained to think in a certain way, we are trained to believe in evidence-based medicine and all of that. But on the other hand, you are heavily invested in what we call alternative or integrative medicine. And it's not something that those of us who are trained in medicine are trained to believe in. Do you find it conflicting? Do you find it like there was an inner conflict within yourself? Do I believe in this or do I believe in that? What do I tell, you know, my patients?
Yeah, Laura, that is a very, I would say, it's a question that I had also as I was embarking on this journey. It's something that I have learned to sort of navigate the middle point after being in this journey for almost 9 years. I think these questions came up when I was very initial in my sort of discovery into the complementary therapies. And then I realized that no system is wrong, but it is our perception and our belief surrounding it. So if we believe that only A can solve a problem, or we believe that I'm going to die with A, then we just stick to that belief. And all our actions actually stem from that belief. But the moment we can actually question our belief and ask ourselves, is this really true? Could there be something else? Let me investigate further. Then what is actually happening is that we are slowly taking agency for our own health. Along the way, as I was slowly studying complementary therapies, then I realized that it is two different systems. It's like you can't actually compare the Western medicine system and the Eastern medicine system. They are two very different health models, and they are both effective, but there are also a lot of undiscovered, I would say, truth about both. And it is really up to the person who is doing the research to come to an agreement of what is conflicting and what is not. After I started, like, I think halfway into the journey, then I realized that what is actually my role here. It is basically to give an informed healthcare view, as well as to not reject what the modern science do not know. Because what is happening is that in the world of evidence-based medicine, there is also this dismissive tendencies of just because we can't prove something, then we are rejecting it as untrue. But actually, a lot of Eastern medicine practice has stood the test of time. Like, it is still here after 3,000 years old, after 5,000 years old, people are practicing it, and more people are practicing it, especially yoga. And it's working. So if something is working and millions of people are actually practicing and benefiting from it, why is there a need to why can't that be a more stark evidence as opposed to something that we are pumping money actively and, you know, I'm talking about running research and all these things. So there's a lot of financial and economic implications also added to that. But I think as a human being, we can choose what we want to believe in. The more you sort of put that lens of like, you know, okay, I want to see what is the truth behind this, then you will sort of arrive to a lot of, truth.
What I got from all of that is that you're saying each one of us has agency over our physical and mental health, and that agency is often taken away from us in the sense that we expect professionals to know better than us, to tell us what to do, to give us medicine, to treat us, but we are not taking charge of our own health. And part of what you did was you found yoga, and that gave you back your agency over your own health. And that's something that we're going to dive deep into later on. But it does seem that you have managed to reconcile both your professional halves and your other half, let's say your after five half.
Right.
In your work, you're working in the traditional and complementary medicine division in MOH. I think that not many people even know that there's such a division. Could you tell us a bit more about what you do on a day-to-day basis?
Okay, so I just joined the TNCM, Traditional and Complementary Medicine Division, this year. So as you can see, I actually made a choice to come here. So after having practiced clinical medicine for, actually I only practiced real critical medicine in my housemanship years. After that, when I was in Sarawak, I was doing enforcement work. And then when I got back into hospital, I was doing logistics. I was already not so clinically inclined in the past, maybe the last 5 years or so. Then I decided, like, okay, since I'm already, you know, doing a lot of research on the side about complementary medicine, why don't I see if I can, you know, move somewhere else? And that's when I found out that, oh, there's actually a division in Ministry of Health called the TNCM division. So we are actually under the Bahagian Perubatan, the medical division. And what we do on a daily basis, we are like regulating the TNCM practitioners. It's like, okay, for doctors, we have the Malaysian Medical Council to register the doctors. And if it's pharmacists, we have the Malaysian Pharmacy Board. We are something like that. We are gatekeepers for people who are practicing traditional and complementary medicine practices in Malaysia. We are involved in things like creating policies, creating guidelines for safe and beneficial practice of TNCM-related activities. And also we do a lot of research in the TNCM area. So like example, like we have government hospitals. One such example is like a National Cancer Institute, where we have TNCM, traditional Chinese medicine herbs being given, or like acupuncture. You can actually do acupuncture in IKN. And then we have also hospital rehab churas. There is one arm of traditional Indian medicine being practiced in hospital rehab churas. We are actually integrating traditional and complementary medicine practices into the mainstream medicine as well. But all of these are, again, you need to ask for this kind of consult. Normal doctors, they would not hand into you and say something like, okay, this is another thing that we have here, we can try. So it's more of like, okay, if you know about it, you can ask the doctor to refer you to such practices. But it's good that we have created a lot of guidelines and there is a lot of policies surrounding it. So policies is always where we start. And then from there, the practice can grow. I think the division is about maybe 10 years old now. So much has happened in the past 10 years. And I see that it is going to expand even more. That's what we do on a daily basis in the division.
So those of you who are listening in on this show, now you know there is a traditional and complementary medicine division in Ministry of Health Malaysia. Although right now, as Shivanti pointed out, it's not like you can walk into your klinik kesihatan and tell your doctor, hey, I want a prescription or a referral to do acupuncture or to have a traditional or a complementary alternative to what I to my treatment. Although you can't do that right now, but with the progress that has been made in a division that is just 10 years old, which is nothing at all, if you look at the big picture, we look forward to a future where you can do that and doctors and other clinical practitioners in Malaysia will be aware of how much this could possibly benefit their patients.
Yeah, Laura, I would just like to add, actually, you can actually ask for the doctor to see a TNCM doctor, but you just need to know which of the healthcare facilities that has that facility. So if let's say now you have back pain and you want to try TCM, you can actually ask the doctor, like, I think if you are in, I'm not sure if it's a Putrajaya hospital, maybe if you see an MO in Putrajaya orthopedic department, you can just say, doctor, I heard that there is a acupuncture session being done for back pain. Do you happen to know, you know, any other clinic kesihatan? You can actually ask for referral.
Thank you for that correction. Yeah. I didn't really didn't know that. My mistake. Perhaps we can then look forward to a future where the availability is more widely available rather than just restricted to specific facilities.
Yeah, I think there are about 15 hospitals now that I'm talking about government hospitals that already have TNCM practices. Not so much of clinic kesihatan, it is more in definitely in the major hospitals, like Sungai Buloh Hospital is one of it. And then I know Hospital Kepala Batas in Pulau Pinang. But with COVID and all, a lot of things are put on hold. But definitely there is.
That's good to know. Now, I've been following Jivanti's yoga journey, or should I say transformative journey, for some time now. And I became very fascinated with her story. I could see that there were changes happening in her. I could see that there were beneficial changes happening to her. And I really wanted to get her on the show to talk about this. It took us some time to get this scheduled, but here we are. So thank you, Jivanti.
Welcome, most welcome. I should say thank you to you for resonating.
So before we dive into the subject of yoga, what is your understanding of what mental health is?
I think just to put it simply, mental health is a very subjective term. But my take of it is that the internal landscape of our mind is a private place. And I think with COVID happening in the last 1.5 years or so, it has actually put a lot of emphasis on what mental health is. But I always like to see the light at the end of the tunnel. I think the whole pandemic has given us an opportunity to truly be intimate with us. You know, in that note, I would like to share something that my teacher in TIFA, like, she introduced this concept of intimacy. And she said the word intimacy, actually, it means into me see. It means to see myself deeper.
I love that. To mm-hmm. see yourself deeper.
Yeah, I'm not sure it actually has, it's from Italian or Greek, but that is the word, probably if you look it up, you would see the word intimacy. We always relate intimacy to something romantic or something in relational with someone, but actually it is in relation to ourselves.
It's like we focus so much on our relationship, intimate relationship with other people, but we have never focused on our relationship with ourselves.
Exactly. So mental health is all about looking deeper into the mind space. And definitely yoga has a huge role in it. On that note, I would like to ask you, like, have you ever practiced yoga? Like, what is your personal experience with it?
I must confess, I've had nothing but the most superficial experience with yoga. I've always found it very difficult. And as with most difficult things that require physical exertion, I would give up. But I did try yoga years ago. And it was because at the time I had very persistent lower back pain. It started when I started working as a pharmacist. And it got so bad that at some point I couldn't take off my pants. I couldn't put on my pants either because I couldn't bend without pain. They did scans, they did tests. They said that I had desiccated disc and my spine was that of a 50-year-old woman. They also told me that I couldn't do high-impact sports. I would have to be very careful not to fall and injure my back further. And I would have to be very careful. If I got pregnant or I put on a lot of weight, there would be issues. Basically, I would be in some degree of pain for the rest of my life. And as you can imagine, that was devastating to hear for someone who was 26 years old. I became very fearful of doing sports. I became fearful of anything that could potentially make me fall. For example, hiking on slippery trails, climbing, for fear that I would fall down. And I discovered yoga. I went for yoga. I heard that it was good for strengthening back muscles and for spinal health. It did improve to a certain degree, the pain. As soon as I saw improvements and it got harder, I decided to stop. But at that point, I also realized that partially some of my pain was actually a physical manifestation of a lot of emotional pain I was carrying around. A lot of stress, a lot of emotional turmoil and baggage that I had probably been carrying around for a long time. And it was at that point that I also started to think about how to address that emotional pain, how to basically try and tackle the root of the problem instead of continuing to focus on the physical aspects of it. This connection between your body and your mind is something that we're going to talk about a lot more in this episode.
Right. Definitely, that is very true, Laura. Like I do not deny that the fact that when we talk about yoga, everybody say, "Oh, I'm not flexible, so I can't do yoga," you know. But that is the glorification of yoga, I would say, you know, the drawback of the glorification of yoga. While yoga actually help you to go beyond your physical body. That's why people can contort themselves in this kind of absolutely impossible poses and still achieve it. But that actually has become a barrier for people to practice yoga, you know. One key thing that I would like to highlight here is that the teacher whom you meet the first time in your yoga journey also plays a very important role on whether you're going to continue yoga or not. Predominantly with people who come with already some compromised physical ills in terms of having pain, then the teacher actually should put them in a place of not actually making yoga a standard prescription for everybody in the class. Yoga is not that complicated. Like even you do the simple poses, but you do it correctly, and you don't actually have to do all those very fancy poses for you to be healed from your pain. Even just basic sun salutation done right and breathing exercises can cure you from a lot of physical ailments. So I think that like what you said, even when you did not persist with it, the pain still managed to go away. And you came to a realization that there could be some emotional component added to the pain, you know. So that is what people discovered after many years of doing yoga. Probably you are somebody who is more introspective, who's more aware of, you are more connected to your body, I would say, to be able to actually come to that realization. So a lot of people, they can never connect their pain in the lower back to something that they've been carrying for years, especially emotional pain. So people come to yoga for so many different reasons.
And I've never thought about that. And for those of you who are listening, maybe at this point you start thinking about your own experiences, whether maybe you've tried yoga in the past and like me, didn't persist with it. Maybe you're also in pain, physical pain, and you didn't realize that, you know, there could be an emotional component to that pain.
Yeah, definitely. And I would say, like, if you try yoga with one teacher, it doesn't work, don't be discouraged. If you find yoga was what this particular type of yoga that you tried is too fast for you, you know, I would say be open, go and try other classes with other teachers, even take up some gym classes, see what fits you, because yoga has gone through so much of adaptations in the past, maybe the last 50 to 100 years, that I can say there is one type of yoga for everybody. Definitely give yoga a chance.
Can you maybe give our audience a little bit of background what yoga is as you have been practicing it? Because evidently I have a very superficial knowledge of, I didn't know
Yeah.
it, I had no idea that it was as complex and as big as you are describing it.
It's actually a deep science. Like what we see a lot of physical postures, it's also called asana. Okay, I would use some Sanskrit terms here and there. But essentially, when we study yoga deeper, it is just a personal development system that uses our body, breath, and the mind to truly learn deeper about ourselves. So that quality of into me see, yoga is just a tool for you to become intimate with yourself. Yoga has never meant to be an external practice, but rather it's like a discipline to draw in attention inwards. So the more we pay attention to what is happening inside of us, the less we will pay attention to what is happening outside of us. So a lot of mental health issues happen also because of the relation and the relational thought that is happening inside us in relation to what we think about what the other person is thinking about me.
It's how you react to external factors,
Exactly.
your
So
reactions.
reaction. So the quality that yoga brings is more of responsiveness, responding as opposed to reacting. So a lot of mental health symptoms are basically it's the body's way of reacting to the external stimulus, whatever it may be.
Can you elaborate a bit more? Like, what is reacting versus responding?
Okay, to put it simply, what actually differentiates reacting and responding is the space in between. Like there's a pause. I would just give you an example. Like, okay, say when we get angry at someone and a fight breaks out. Okay, say somebody is in a heated argument and then they hurt the other person physically. Okay, so what happens there is a reaction. This person has all this overwhelmed emotions inside of them that is coming out as anger. So the body actually, here I would like to introduce a system, a term called the body as a container. Okay, the body as a container means it contains all your emotions. So within you, you feel all these emotions, like you can feel your ears are getting warm. You can feel, you know, your heart rate is going up. And then, you know, your breath is getting faster. You are angry. So this is what your body is reacting. Your body is containing all these emotions. But these emotions also need to be channeled out. That's why people hit someone when they are angry. Because there's so much of emotional, there's so much of energy that is stored in that emotions of anger. So what happens when they hit someone, then suddenly they realize that that energy is already being transferred outwards. It becomes a reaction. Then when you hit someone, chances are that the other person is going to hit you back, or they are going to feel extremely hurt instantaneously, right? So there is already a snowballing effect there. That is as far as reaction is concerned. But what happened when you respond? Respond is like you can observe that you are feeling all those feelings. You are still that container who's holding the anger. But there is a momentary pause in where you realize I'm getting angry and I'm going to leave this place. Or I'm going to say something like, I'm very angry now. I think we need to stop. It's just as simple as that. So that in itself is you responding. So when you respond, chances are that the snowballing effect actually stops with you, as opposed to you transferring the energy to someone else.
It sounds like something that you would know instinctively, and yet I would say that most human beings are by nature reactive. They exactly. react without thinking. So exactly. how does yoga come into this?
It is because our nervous system, okay, the nervous system is the system that processes all emotions and respond to stimulus. It's a very biological process. So like what you said, everybody knows that they're not supposed to get angry. They still get angry. So that's a very biological process. You can't actually stop yourself from getting angry. So where does yoga come? Yoga is a tool to strengthen your immune system. If I would say something about yoga to help your emotions, it strengthens your immune system. It's like how we say you have muscles and you carry weights to train your muscle. So yoga is just training that nervous system. You will never hear about a drug that can train your nervous system. Mm. But I can tell you after practicing yoga for like X number of years, at least 7 years, I would say this is the most important aspect of yoga in terms of relating it to science.
And I believe you're saying that it somehow changes how your brain functions.
Yes, it changes your response to the stimuli, like how you perceive the event. And it's actually biological. Like your brain actually starts to wire differently. The network of neurons that is communicating in your brain, different parts of the brain is being targeted. It's no longer the emotional brain that is taking over. You know, so we will speak about this shortly, about the different types of what are the parts of the brain. But essentially, to put it simply, it helps you to build emotional resilience, which is pretty much what every person, every adult needs. You know, not only adults, I think now teenagers are being bombarded with so much of stimulus, so much so that emotional resilience is not, it's not a want anymore. It's not, it is a need already.
I fully, fully agree, because in a way, that's why MindBrew was set up to make people aware that mental health is far more than just the lack or presence of a disorder. Mental health is really about a state of well-being from physical aspect, mental aspect, social, psychological. It's a complete package. And the trouble with our society now is also that we are focusing on only one aspect of development. We are focusing on development in the sense that is this economically viable? Is this something that will help drive the economy, make more money? We're not talking about spiritual development. We're not talking about emotional development. And as you so rightly pointed out, this has very severe repercussions on our youth, our younger generation, because they are not being taught to be self-aware. They're not being trained to be emotionally resilient. They are trained to graduate from school and become another cog in the workings of society to make more money, to generate more wealth. It's a systemic problem. It's something that we could be talking about the whole night long and not come to any sort of conclusion. So maybe we'll leave that to another day. What you said just now was so interesting. I've never thought that there was like a biological component to how to the practice of yoga, how it changes us biologically. It means that it inherently changes how your body works, how your brain works. Because there's always been so much emphasis on how yoga is a spiritual practice. So what's your take on that? How can you explain that a bit more?
Historically, and to bring the context of yoga from where it started in India. So yoga was actually taught as it's like a human evolution practice to develop your consciousness. In those days, not everybody practiced yoga. Like you need to follow an eightfold path. It's something called Ashtanga yoga. Ashtanga means the philosophy. Ashta means eight and Anga means limbs. So there are eight paths that you need to incorporate before you can find a teacher to teach you yoga. So the first thing is called yama or moral code. It's how you behave, your relationship with people. And the niyamas, your own personal behavior. And then we do asana, which is the physical postures. That is what you see everywhere online today. Okay. After you do the physical postures, you go into pranayama, which is basically breathing deduced to breathing techniques. Okay. And then something called pratyahara, withdrawal of the senses. So withdrawal of the senses is what we need to do today. We are being bombarded by stimulus, especially social media. Today, we can't live without our phone. But this ancient practice has said, by withdrawing our senses inwards, we can actually evolve to become a better human being. This has been said maybe 5,000 years ago. And then once you withdraw your senses, then you can build a sense of dharana or concentration. You know, you bring focus into your life when you stop looking outside. And then the state of dhyana, basically meditation. And finally is samadhi. Samadhi is like merging with the divine. It is where you realize you are spirit. Now, I think the quality of being spirit is talked about in all religions, but yoga is not religious. That's why you see yoga is practiced all around the world. So if you ask me, when you practice yoga, you become a better Muslim. You become a better Christian. Whatever you are, whatever role that you take in life, you become better at it when you do yoga. So it is just an integrated approach of daily practices to guide you towards realizing who you are. You know, so if you realize yourself as I'm an angry person, okay, and you take on that identity. I believe that I've been angry. I've done all these things in the past. This is why I'm angry. After years of doing yoga, you realize that anger is just my emotion. I am not an angry person. So there's two different distinctions there. Like you transcend your physical reality of like me, I'm Jivanti, I'm so and so. Two, these are just my qualities. To put it simply, being spiritual is just that you recognize the quality of spirit. So what is the quality of being spirit? You're unattached, you're liberated, you're non-judgment, you practice unconditional love. So these are all the qualities of spirit, right? So to say, When you do yoga, what actually happens is that your consciousness expands. a lot of people testify to being kinder after they start practicing yoga. So this aspect of being kind happens only when the analytical and judgmental qualities of the mind is being dropped. So that is in essence how someone becomes more spiritual after doing yoga. And it's very different for everybody, but there are some ground sort of agreeable terms when you speak to people who are doing yoga for many years.
In that case, would you say that most people now, what they know of yoga and the stage at which they stop at is simply asana? They don't look at the other seven arms of what yoga encompasses. They stop there.
I think asana is where they get the first image of yoga. But the moment they start practicing, and I think a lot of yoga teacher training now has gone beyond the asana already. It's just that because asana is easier to draw people through asana. Mm. Like, you know, when you see somebody standing on your head, on their head, now you'll be like, wow, that's so cool. I want to do that.
Mm-mm.
You know, that's where it starts. But the moment they become a consistent practitioner, they are already moving beyond asana. They already know that. And I just want to tell you, Laura, this eight arms, it happens simultaneously every day. Like I can just be holding my hand in a hand gesture. I'm also practicing withdrawal of senses. When I close my eyes, I'm already withdrawing my senses. So, you know, it doesn't matter what asana you do. At any time, you are actually practicing all the eight arms. It's just how deep you are into it. So you don't have to be doing headstand to know the other seven aspects of yoga. And this people start to realize once they start practicing.
Thank you for explaining that. And certainly, thank you for pointing out the difference between spirituality and religion, because I have seen people who are very opposed to yoga as a practice because they say it's deviant, it's against their religion, and that's so inaccurate and so untrue. As you rightly pointed out, yoga is a spiritual practice. It actually helps you become a better person. It does not mean that you're subscribing to a specific god or set of beliefs about that so-called god. So you can practice yoga and be a better Muslim. You can practice yoga and be a better Christian.
Exactly. It's just like you don't have to identify with the, you know, of course, yoga coming from India, there is the religious component to it. But you do not even have to believe in yoga to feel the benefits. So just do it and then you see that it works. So you can take what works for you. And because yoga has spread all throughout the world, you will never go to a class and teachers telling like, you have to say this. You have to start the class by saying Om or Namaste or whatever, you know. Yeah, the teacher will always say, like, you know, if you're not comfortable, you don't have to do it. Yeah, and because we especially, like, I think in the Malaysian context, we are so respectful of people's belief. And I personally, in the last 5 years, have seen more and more Muslim friends who start to practice yoga. There's a lot now, and yoga is very mainstream now. People from all walks of life are just practicing, you know. You don't have to, you can just leave the religious aspect aside.
So we can see that people are coming to learn yoga. There are more and more people are coming to learn yoga because they do see there's a benefit to it. They do see there's a connection between yoga and better health. And we have established early on in the conversation talking about the mind-body link, and how yoga actually, the consistent daily practice of yoga actually changes the way that your brain functions. Can we like to dive a bit deeper into the connection between yoga and mental health? Let's look at the details of how that happens.
Okay, so to put it simply, yoga is an Eastern medicine system, okay? Just like traditional Chinese medicine, or like when you're doing Tai Chi or Qigong, you know, this kind of Eastern practices. It comes from the premise that the body, the mind, and the spirit or soul or whatever you would call it, is actually connected. It is an integrated network of dynamic change. And this basically means that whatever actions that happens in your body has a corresponding change internally. So internally is basically how our mind works, the psyche, how the psyche develops, or the emotions that is happening inside of you. And as opposed to the Western medicine system, the basic principle is very segmented. And by that, I mean, it almost does not recognize that beyond the body, there is something called the mind and the spirit. So that's why, like, we have in the Western medical system, a specialist for every organ and system. You have heart problem, call the cardiologist. You know, you have some bone to set, you know, contact the orthopedics, you know, something like that. But the Eastern medicine system largely understands that the fundamental truth is that the body cannot be separated as systems. Although it works as systems, but every Eastern medicine practitioners or doctors that you go to, they would always look at the system as a whole. So that's why you have something like, oh, you do this one practice or you take this one herb, it can actually help you with many organs. But if you really see it objectively, it is so true. Because when your body digests a certain medicine, it is your blood. Your blood carries that essence of the medicine to everywhere. Why does it not make sense that a particular herbs that you take for your liver can actually help your spleen or stomach or your heart? Why does it have to be, I have to take this one medicine for just my heart? It's only going to work on my heart alone. So they always see everything as a bigger picture perspective and not so much of very segmented.
You're absolutely right. We have not yet succeeded in creating a drug therapy, a medication that only affects the things that it's supposed to affect and nothing else. We are not quite at that level yet. Maybe one day we will be as science and technology gets more and more advanced. But the thing is, if you take a medication, it will go where it's supposed to go, but you also go everywhere else it's not supposed to go. Maybe in a smaller trace amounts, but it still will go there.
Exactly. So what the pharmaceutical company have done is that they have focused on targeted therapy. So they talk about what the benefits is for this particular organs, but you know, the other side of it is not very much talked about. Whereas on the Eastern system, they use that approach and that premise to basically heal you as a whole.
And looking at that, saying that Western medicine segregates everything in isolation, I've always wondered whether this is somewhat like a case of the blind man and the elephant, if you know that story. Because you're blind, you can only see one thing at a time. You can only feel one thing at a time. You will only have part of the story. You don't have the whole story. And therefore, there is a risk of misdiagnosing a person or simply piling more and more treatments that are possibly unnecessary unto a person without even knowing what is the actual root cause. You're treating symptom after symptom after symptom, but you're not getting to the root cause. So that's one, I would say, not to say flaw, but maybe weakness of the Western medicine system.
Yeah, exactly. So we tend to glorify something that we have seen only a small part of it. You know, it's like bringing that sort of magnifying glass to just this particular part and then magnifying that problem, when actually it could just be a small thing with respect to how you see the whole body, you know, as a system. Yeah, like what you said, you know, sometimes we can get misdiagnoses, we can get overprescribed. And then there's also this other component of believing that I have this disease for the rest of my life. I think that is something that we need to move away from, to empower someone to take care of their health.
And when that relates to mental health problems, how would you see this as a problem? Because mental health, people think, oh, it's the brain, you know, it's the mind. But where's the connection between the body and the mind? And how does yoga come into this?
I think like the mental health problems that we have today is basically a sort of a glaring consequences of the disfragmented belief of a Western medicine system. It stems from us being disconnected with the mind, because whatever that is happening in the mind is very overwhelming to the senses and to ourselves. And that is when we start to say mental health issues, mental health issues, mental health issues. You know, it sort of creates a stigma around it, and it doesn't allow, it creates a labeling of some sort.
I agree.
But how yoga comes into this is because yoga is the antidote of this. Yoga is like coming home to yourself, your own self. And like I told you, the self is the container. So when you start looking deeper inside, and the most beautiful part about yoga is that it teaches you this quality of non-judgment. See, being analytical and being judgy is not wrong. It is what your mind is trained to do. The mind cannot exist without being analytical or judgmental, but it is the over-identification to that judgment quality that makes us criticize ourselves and also others. See, that is where a lot of mental health symptoms comes in. The ability to not accept myself for who I am because I do not know my trauma. I do not know the other person's trauma. There's so many things that are not spoken about when someone is having a mental health issues. And yet, the very person that needs that compassion of I am a mental health patient does not get it. They tend to, you know, the stigma sort of makes it worse.
Mm-hmm.
And then we give them treatment that disempower them largely after a certain amount of time, that even medications are not empowering at all. You know, you take for a certain period of time, then you have to do other things already. Because I think at this point, I would like to point something here, Laura. Even when you take psychiatric medicines, biologically, your brain changes.
Mm,
you know,
that's right.
So your brain could actually potentially be less and less effective with the medications as time goes on to handle your mental health issues. That's why I think we as pharmacists, we also know that a lot of mental health medicines, like psychiatric medicines, even the side effects are the same as the symptoms themselves. And why does that even happen? It is because of how it works on the different parts of the brain. So this part, this particular aspect is not actually deeply looked into, especially when you take that choice to put on someone for an indefinite amount of time, which is what we see in a lot of mental health clinics, patients being prescribed indefinitely of antipsychotics, you know, or psychiatric medicines. So there is definitely a need to add in other things inside. Like it's not sustainable just to put someone on psychiatric medicines and then feel bad when they're not getting better.
I do agree with that to a certain extent. Medications do have their place in therapy, especially when someone is very acutely unwell. They are in danger of hurting themselves. They're in danger of hurting other people, maybe. And that at that point in time, medication is important. It is a part of their treatment. And as time goes by, it's very important to actually remember that medication was never meant to be the only solution.
Mm.
Psychiatric illnesses, whether it be depression, schizophrenia, bipolar, and all that, they are multifactorial. There are many reasons and many causes, many possible causes as to why a person has these disorders. And because of that, the way that we help recovery, we aid healing, is also multi-pronged. We have to use different modalities. That may include medication. It usually includes medication, but it also includes talk therapy, psychotherapy. It includes helping that person find community, find connection with other people. It also includes things like helping that person live an independent life, gain a few value in his or her life. So it's a complicated issue. It's a complex issue. And what we're saying here is that medication is not the only solution, but it is helpful to some people.
Exactly. Especially in the beginning, like, you know, in the beginning to like get you back as a human being, you know,
mm-hmm.
because a lot of mental health symptoms, there is a sense of alienation and isolation. And then there's so much of mental energy that is happening within someone who has mental health symptoms, that they do not have the energy to do anything else. So the medicine actually plays a big role in basically giving you back that sense of, okay, I'm here. You know, this, I feel a little bit human, you know, to put it simply. You know?
I resonate so strongly with what you just said. It made me think of this book, Lost Connections, by Johan Hari. I first heard of this book when I watched a TED Talk that he did. And in this book, Johan Hari dissects the real reason, the root causes of why people are anxious and depressed, why the rates of depression and anxiety have shot up over the past few decades. And he himself is someone who's lived with depression for many years. He's been on medication for many years, and he's not a mental health professional, but he's a journalist by profession. And in this book, he dissected based on interviews with experts, researchers, and many, many people who have lived experience of mental disorders like depression, anxiety, bipolar, schizophrenia. He dissected that the reason, the root cause is disconnection. In the book, he put forth 9 causes, 9 dimensions, including disconnection from other people, disconnection from meaningful work, values, disconnection from childhood trauma, status and respect from the natural world, and from a hopeful, secure future, and the role of genes and brain changes. So all of this leads to an epidemic of extreme loneliness. This disconnection leads to loneliness, something that no amount of medication can fix without tackling the root cause of disconnection. I'm going to put the link to the TED Talk and the book in the show notes. So I strongly urge that if you want to understand, if you yourself are going through something and you want to understand why you are the way that you are, please go watch the TED Talk or read the book. It offers a lot of insights, and hopefully will also get you thinking about how you can address the root causes of your depression, of your anxiety, of your whichever mental health issues that you are going through. And look, what you just said was actually, everything that you just said was really, really deep. I think we need to take some time to unpack this, to process it. Because the practice of yoga, you said, enables us to come home to ourselves, to the self. It enables us to build this self-awareness of who we are.
Exactly, Laura. That is actually what happens when we become adult. I think everyone who becomes adult, we know that we go through so much of experiences, life experiences, and all of us have gone through this, you know, a breakup, a loss of job, someone dying, you know, change in environment, you know, so many of these things that does not, that sometimes tend to displace us, you know, and we start to think, where are we in the sphere of all these things that is happening in our life? You know, how do we make sense of all these inconvenient experiences in our life? Because the mind also has this tendency to gravitate towards pleasure, you know, and to navigate away from pain. But actually, essentially what yoga is it is a practice to bring you to that awareness, to see life as it is, not as how you want it to be.
See life as it is, not as you want it to be.
Exactly, you know, which is what all adult is going through. You know, so when someone, example, when someone passes on, someone we love pass on, the first natural response to that is denial. So the longer we stay in denial, the longer it's going to take for us to heal. And while we are not healing, we are also not showing up for the people in our lives and allow them to support us. So yoga basically is just a tool for you to see something as it is unfolding in front of you and not live in this illusion. And that's why I told you it is a tool to develop human consciousness. It is not an exercise, because the key component there is awareness. It's only when you are aware of something, you can actually do something about it. It's like how if you are a super angry person all the time, until someone stops you and give you that reflection and tell you like, hey, look, you are so hurting or whatever, then you stop and you realize, oh, this person is reflecting something back. And then you become aware, right? That key thing that actually moves the needle towards growing you as a person is actually awareness. Awareness is only the first step before transforming yourself.
Yoga is definitely not just another workout.
Definitely not. Because, you know, when you are running on a treadmill, you know, nobody's telling you, you know, become aware of your heartbeat, become aware of how you're breathing and see where your focus is going. Are you thinking about what you said yesterday to someone, or are you thinking about the job that you have not gone? It's the thinking about the past and thinking about the future. You're not in the present. So everybody talks about let's live in the present moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
So yoga is basically just a tool to live in the present moment. And the more you start doing the practice, the more your neurology of your brain changes, and how, you know, you physiologically and psychologically become someone else. And that's why yoga is taught in prisons. Like, you know, in the US, they have something called the Prison Yoga Project.
Wow.
Yeah. So they train prison inmates to become yoga teachers. And this program has actually been very successful. So if you can really see, the prison is a highly toxic environment, in a sense that everybody there has got some kind of issues.
Mm-hmm.
But even in that kind of environment, yoga can be something so positive and transforming.
Mm.
You can imagine what it can do to someone who's just normal adults. So that's why now it's like, you can see almost the statistics every year that the people who are practicing yoga across the world, it has increased exponentially, and it will not stop. It is simply because it is working.
I think that people are searching for solutions. Exactly. They are searching for ways to help themselves to get out of that trap, that feel, you know, that sense of pain or struggle or whatever it is that they feel trapped in. And we were discussing this earlier, and you had some very interesting thoughts about it. We both had. Do you think that we've been talking a lot about self-awareness? Do you think that people sometimes resist being self-aware because they're not quite sure that they will like what they find?
Yeah, exactly. I think that is a very important point that you said. I think sometimes people mistake self-awareness for self-honesty. Self-awareness is just you being aware. But I think the key to moving you to transforming your life is self-honesty. You know, the degree in which you are radically honest with yourself is the degree to which you can carry that honesty to any other relationships you have in your life. So if you are somebody who's not trained to look at yourself compassionately, and you're always criticizing yourself, then the projection that you're going to carry outwards is perfectionist tendencies.
Mm.
You know, because you can't accept yourself as imperfect, you tend to project that as having perfection from other people. So we see this a lot in corporate world.
Mm-mm.
Where we have bosses who are not empathetic. That in itself is actually hones down to the degree of self-awareness and self-honesty that someone is training themselves to develop. I would say this is a training. I don't think most adults are even trained in this. I think life trains you for that.
Mm.
You know? But again, it comes back to how introspective and reflective are you in your life experiences.
I would imagine that process of becoming self-aware and actually looking at yourself with radical honesty, as you just put, would be very uncomfortable, and people would even say that it is painful. And yes, like you said, our natural tendency as human beings is to avoid pain.
But as you have rightly put, pain is just another side of growth. Like, you can't have growth without pain. You
That's
know,
correct.
All adults would instinctively agree to this. Like, whatever good that has happened in their life, it did not come easily. There had to be some moment of, you know, personal challenges that came with that. It's also this, like, sometimes when we look at ourselves, will we like ourselves more? Or will the other person like ourselves? If they see this part of me, are they still going to love me? That is the most important question, because we all seek a sense of belonging in our life. And sometimes we go to greater extent to lie to ourselves, you know, first, and then carrying that lie to the people whom we live with, you know. Again, this is your own journey. It is really not about anyone else, but it is that willingness and that unconditional love you have for yourself. Like, do I want to see myself for who I am? So what yoga does, yoga just helps you to do that. And in all whatever poses that you're doing, you will get there. So that's the beauty of it.
I think one thing to point out here is that pain by itself doesn't mean anything. Of course you avoid pain, right? I mean, it's not pleasant, it's uncomfortable. Who wants pain? But pain plus reflection equals growth. You will never grow without that aspect of reflection, understanding why you are, who you are, and you know why you do the things that you do. So pain plus reflection equals growth.
Yeah, and I would also add transformation, like in a sense that action. There has to be something beyond your pain. Like, you feel the pain and then you reflect on it. And then it's that agency. What do I want to do next? You know, because if you stay there, then you are just going to be this hyper self-aware person who feels everything intensely. And then what? We have to be, sensitivity is very, very important. But sometimes we have to go beyond taking a lot of things personally. So this also becomes very challenging in relationships. Because when we do not know how to not take things personally, that can also be the cause of mental health issues.
You've been listening to part one of our two-part episode on yoga, spirituality, and mental health with Jivanti, pharmacist, freelance yoga teacher, health coach, life coach, and founder of Wild Hearts, Adventures in Mindful Living. Stay tuned for part two of this episode by following our social media platforms at MindBrewKCH. That's MindBrewKCH. See you soon!